From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm Jay Bradley Menhick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities.
Ladies and gentlemen, in my old age, I have become a pontificator. And I mean here tonight to orate, dissermatate, coagulate, both bob and discombobulate on a subject most important to me. I'll sing on the topic of folk songs through folk songs.
Today we'll be talking with folk singer and writer Willie Carlisle and director and designer Joseph Fletcher. Their award-winning one-man play, There Ain't No More, Death of a Folk Singer, is based on the legends of American folk music and the early vaudeville stage.
My love is a river where the white waters pour. I hunted and trapped her by the gates of Lodore. She sings with the spirit of cool mountain rain, where I won her bright silver in the high Coeur d'Alene.
The play recounts and recollects one man's life, where the singer uses every trick to confront his past adventures in the American wilderness and wax and wane about the sometimes existential dilemma of rescuing folk music from obscurity.
She'll never be mine. She'll never be mine.
Prick up your ears for our folk singer and rancontier's last performance on Arts and Letters.
Oh, I want all her treasures so simple and fine. I know she'll never be mine.
Willie Carlisle, theater artist, Ozark Renaissance folklorist and poet, and director and designer, Joseph Fletcher. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Good afternoon.
I know this took 5 years of research. Tell us about the research involved in this. It sounds extensive.
Ever since I was a young man 5 years ago, I had been sort of collecting notes and folk songs, going out and learning folk music from folks in the Arkansas old-time music community. And also I'm kind of doing little bits of archival research where I could for this and that project in the various archives spread across the Ozarks. And I always knew that I wanted to do a one-man folk operetta of some kind that dealt with folk music and death and American culture. So it took about 5 years of writing poems and learning to call square dances and learning to play the fiddle and the banjo and accordion and all that stuff to begin the real process of making the play, which was closer to nine months.
And that's when I came into the project. Me and Willie had worked in a theater company called the Artist Laboratory Theater in Fayetteville, and we'd worked on a number of shows making original plays together. And he came to me about 9 months ago and asked, hey, I got this personal project. Would you be interested in doing it with me? And came in with about 100 pages worth of stuff, just an amalgam of, from all these different places. And I think the idea for, what, 2-3 scenes already sort of shaped out a little bit in your head. And then we spent the next 2 months sort of just going through it, ordering things, organizing it, talking about the narrative, what it could be, trying to put disparate parts together to form a cogent idea, and started to shape a script. And then we started moving to rehearsals once we felt that was stronger, and cut it down even more. And eventually we got to about a little over an hour show and about 30 pages worth of text.
Yeah. And I think we came out with a show that's got a little bit of everything for everybody, in that some of it's monologues, some of it's poetry, some of it's puppetry, some of it is just pure music, just singing. Some of it is instrumentation. It's got a whole lot of bells and whistles in it. And I think that all of those bells and whistles emerged from picking the best pieces of this 100-page massive document.
Folks, I will tell you that I'm most grateful to be in a small audience of mostly dear friends, as I'm on considerable medication for my condition, and I may be in and out of lucidity for the duration. I say this in part so that you will not question the validity of everything I say and do and label it a flashback, which would be infuriating. No matter how committed it seems that I might be to things that happened in the past, I guarantee you that insofar as we are anywhere, we are here, in this room, in the present, together. And because the present is a gift, I encourage you to turn to the person sitting next to you and to tap them, gently, lovingly, if you can muster it, on the shoulder. Just so. This is in part to ensure that we are, in fact, not ghosts. My love's a cantina where I drink with my friends. I called her Dolores and sometimes Cheyenne. I followed her begging all over the West. My love is a headline on the Midnight Express. She'll never be mine. She'll never be mine. Though I want all her treasures so simple and fine, I know she'll never be mine. I know she'll never be mine.
So it's an unnamed old man.
Yeah.
You call him our hero. He's on medication. And this is basically his last performance. And he's trying to connect with an audience after, what, 60 years of performing.
Well, and that's the heart of the show to me is this idea of legacy. A lot of these folk practices, folk culture is going away. A lot of the whole people holding up that culture are dying off. And fewer people are stepping up to carry that tradition. And they are here. They are around. But it really makes you ask the question of what's a value, because there's some troubling stuff within folk culture, mm-hmm. but also some absolutely beautiful things of people coming together. In this day and age of information technology, we don't spend enough time singing together, going and eating, breaking bread as a group, dancing as a group. It used to be part of our identity as a culture, and we've drifted from that. And I'm just curious of how much should we be holding on to the old things but embracing the new at the same time.
I do call him our hero, but just because he has no name. In some ways, he's an anti-hero. In some ways, he thinks that he might have wasted his life on these old practices, that he might be a fraud, that he's not an authentic product of a culture, but that rather he's just like a collector of things. But he does sort of want to know, and he wants to ask the audience, where do beautiful things go when nobody does them anymore? If I'm the last person who knows this song and I'm about to die, what do I do? Does it deserve to be saved? Or is the past so problematic that we just want to move on from it? A past of racism and sexism and war and all these other things.
Well, folks, I was diagnosed with congestive heart failure, and I'm going to be here all week. And I don't want any of you lurching up to me offering me folk cures, all right? There's so many healers in this hippie town, it makes me sick. I got a Zen acupuncturist, wears a blindfold, uses darts. The man what did a vasectomy on me, he said he would only do it in the event of a lunar eclipse. I says, well, why is that, brother? He says, well, eclipse, eclipse. I'm reminded of the great Ogden Nash, who once said, progress might have been all right at one point, but it's gone on for too long.
You use banjos, fiddles, guitars, harmonicas, an old accordion, puppets, and a mask. Tell us how you staged this.
At the beginning, I think it looks like just a rather extravagant folk singer's concert. You might have more instruments than your average single musician and a couple more bits of business. There's a couple of boxes on the stage that sort of look old-timey and a nice chair. Really, it's designed to look like a folk concert in the beginning. The show does begin with that mask, that voice that I'm using. And that's because I'm a young man and I want to be able to make a complete transformation into an old person to begin the show.
What does the mask look like?
You know, it's exactly like what I will look like when I'm old. We had it built by the fantastic mask maker.
Octavio Logo. He's a Mexican artist who does a lot of visual arts work, leather binding and things like that. He did a cast of his face.
With liquid latex,
yeah.
Very 21st century technology. It's a thing of beauty, and it's not like a scary clown mask or anything. It's actually just realistic, fits my face like a glove, and now I know what I'll look like. It's not great, but it's a great mask.
Well, I guess in the beginning it was easier to sing and play a lot, and live in your car, do bars, nursing homes, coffee shops, that kind of thing. And I did. And I was tired, so I moved out into the woods where wouldn't nobody bother me. Now, nowadays, I just get out a couple of times a year and go from city to city and try to learn things from people who can out-talk me. In my old age, that gets harder and harder to find. Never had any kids or anything, so I just kind of make audiences into my grandchildren. And y'all are going to sit on my lap whether you like it or not. Well, thank you for listening to the ravings of an old man who doesn't know what he thinks and thinks he knows what he doesn't.
in the reviews, it's interesting because the mass begins the show. Mm. And they point to that and they're like, oh boy, we don't know what we're in for. But then as it unfolds, like the delight from the audience.
It takes about 30 seconds. As soon as he gets the first laugh, and then they seem to be on board with where it's going and what it is.
Like, this is what every person from Arkansas will know. Imagine you're triply trapped inside people's stereotypes. If you're old, if you're ugly, and you're a hillbilly. So like, I turn around and say something with a hillbilly accent in a mask. It's like people think, oh, we're in for Deliverance or the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something. And then it's really a dirty, funny old man there to tell jokes and entertain an audience. So watching that kind of tension drop out of audiences has been one of the most fun parts of doing this show.
Yeah, but long before all that, long before I got my start kicking around North Chicago, big polka bands out there on Saturday nights, I didn't know a thing about it, didn't much care to, until I got drunk early on one night and went and saw my neighbors, gave them a hoot, and they said they were going to some big country dance outside of the city. Said I should come along, be fitted, wined and dined.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to writer and actor Willie Carlisle and designer and director Joseph Fletcher as they talk about their one-man play, There Ain't No More, Death of a Folk Singer.
What happens in the second section? It's a long monologue, and he's a young man.
At the end of our very first part, he takes the mask off, and the moment that the mask comes off, he goes into a younger man's voice.
Now, I'm not much of a fiddle player, but I have been playing for long enough to keep my tongue in my mouth.
And throughout this, you can hear several different voices, some of which are very heavily accented, some of which are not so accented, some of which are completely unaccented. We've done that on purpose to indicate just three ways of him thinking or being that are not necessarily located in a particular time or place, but just that he's younger. The mask is off, it's my face, and the first thing he does is recall a square dance by calling it and playing it on the fiddle.
All join hands, circle to the left, circle south. Put a little moonshine in your mouth. It's back to the right towards Arkansas. Eating cornbread and possum jaw. Gent number one to gent number two. Circle up four like you know what to do. Gent moves on, circles up three. Steals that lady like honey from a bee. Six, go forward, back you holler. Touch him on the butt and give him a dollar.
And then after that, he revels in the idea of what these dances meant to him, talking about what it meant to touch the hands of a bunch of pretty girls and so on.
Holy hell, on a horsefly, there it was. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the most fun you can have standing up. It's hillbillies. It's old folks. It's babies. It's hippies. Can I tell you what it means for an angry young man to touch the hands of dozens of pretty girls, young and old? Oh, the turn of the lay the life. And look there, the pattern of the wheeling dresses, and the rugs rolled up, and the moonshine's overflowing in the proffered cup. Oh, the heft of the feet and the lithe knees, and look there, and the marijuana smoke wafting in the ceiling fan. The babies all scattered and asleep on the quilt, and the dogs playing the smell of a grandmother's pies. The scent of sweet magnolia and honeysuckle air, the touch of warm skin on skin, over and over, swing your partner off the floor, that's all there is, there ain't no more.
Would you tell us a little bit about the poetry in this?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I probably originally had 50 poems somewhere near the script, and they came in and out at various times, and we did a lot of smashing together of poems that I thought were near complete but were somehow unsatisfying to me. And a lot of the poetry that I think I loved didn't find its way into the script. But in a lot of ways, that's better because we're telling a story. And then we found these opportunities for this sensate lyricism that seems more like it could come out of a person. our hero, the folk singer, the old man is a poet, is a writer, is capable of this kind of lyricism. But it's not like an imposition on the script where for some reason now he's speaking in poetry and we can't understand why because this isn't how people speak. Sheet music just couldn't do it. I can understand why some men need a religion of notation to guide them, a little dark scaling mark to remind them of where they are in time and space. But this was like returning home again to a memory you've always had. The angular turns of geography and knowledge are marvelous when they make simple shapes and patterns. And maybe this was tone-deaf music, but it was unafraid to slide and pull off and hammer on with circular, jangled arms, twist-wristed shuffling, an artifact gathered gist-wise who heard it from a groove long gone. Dead man to dead man to live wire. And so it is of a life of its death that skips from hand, to bow to box, to palm and finger, to the top of the human voice box, crying, woo, to touch the beautiful body of a ghost.
I think it's the point where he falls in love. It's all the beautiful things about the tradition he gets to embrace for the first time and fall in love with, which then changes and evolves when we get further into the play where he has to deal with some of the more troubling issues. And then later on in the play again, I think he falls right in love with the music too, but has had to reconcile a lot with the issues and has found a new aspect of love, I guess, for the tradition.
This is before he realized that there could be anything problematic about folk music or like a life spent in it, where he just finds that it's the best things, that it has inroads to sustainable lifestyles, that it gets everybody together, that there's pretty girls and boys that you can hold hands with and so on. And he gets really lyrical in this part. I mean, some of this is literally poems that we have written out on the page.
I'm a man who can't really do much. I never shied away from hard work, never stole anything bigger than a handful of peanuts, but I never built anything as large or as magnificent as that barn that we danced in. Hail. I stole most of what I have now in my head and fingers. And you know how fast that stuff goes away? Stuff in your head and fingers?
In this sense, he begins by confronting his lost love. And that lost love is not only folk music, but also Ruth, also square dancing.
And all those things are supposed to be tied together in part so that, you know, every part of the show can't resonate with everybody to generate this matrix of things. And this is the way that life works, is that when you fall in love with something, you don't have any choice about how that goes. You know, you become vulnerable in what that turns into, and it affects every aspect of your life. And so we didn't want to say he falls in love with this one thing and then he loses it. It's like he falls in love with all of these things. It's a bunch of different beautiful things happening in his life at once. He comes of age, he learns a whole bunch, he falls in love. And then right after this, he gets shipped off to war. He goes to the Vietnam War right after this.
I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and this is Arts and Letters. We're listening to There Ain't No More, Death of a Folk Singer, featuring writer and actor Willie Carlisle and director and designer Joseph Fletcher.
This is in seven beats. Mm-hmm. And the fifth beat is where he confronts the American wilderness.
All right, so past that spring, county road, you're going to come a couple miles down there. You're going to come to some cinder block houses and black mold snakes. You don't want to go in them. So down that road another three-quarter mile, you're going to come across a sugar maple with some drip cans nailed to it. County puts a yellow flag on it sometimes in the springtime. That's how you know it. That's Worley's Road. Well, down that road another couple miles, you're going to come across Shady Grove. It's an old church. It looks kind of like a schoolhouse, but anybody with any sense knows that it's a church, all right? Worley, he used to send his kids down there when he and his wife wanted to make whoopee, right? So the kids would climb all the way down the mountain and break into the church, climb the steeple, and ring the bell. And that was how Worley and his old lady would know they better hurry up. That was exactly how I got directions to Worley Willard's house. They told me that if I brought him a bottle or some peaches or some cigarettes, that in return I might get a couple hours of tunes and recordings out of him.
That was Whirly Willard of Jasper Mountain in Pope County, Arkansas, playing Little Jimmy Wheeler. It's October the 2nd of 1986. Whirly, can you say where you learned that from and how you came to play it? Benefit of the tape. It takes him a minute, or five, to remember one of the hundreds of tunes that he knows. This is difficult music to listen to, but it's a dazzling representation of the music of this area's earliest sharecroppers. Whirly Willard will now play a medley of three fiddle tunes, including 4 and 20 Blackbirds Dancing on a Fawn Skin, Keep Your Fingers Out of That, and Who Went to the Bathroom in Grandpa's Hat. He uses a word besides bathroom for that. Now, Whirly, can you tell us if you play these exactly as your grandpappy played them? Fiddle tunes, when experienced this way, are a sort of cultural ground zero. These tunes use personal styles and regional idiosyncrasies in hyper-conservative microcosms, where the phrase, I learned this tune from, could begin a patrilineal or occasionally matrilineal digression that digs deeper into local social history than almost any other craft. 4. Unlike bodging or potting or embroidery, music is primarily a social activity that gets people together to dance, to court, to touch.
Whirly Willard of Jasper Mountain in Pope County, Arkansas.
We wanted to put Whirly in a very specific place because we knew that Arkansasers would be watching this play. But there is no Whirly Willard of Jasper Mountain in Pope County, Arkansas. But in the play there is. I guess I've had the pleasure of visiting a few fiddle players that do live out in the boondocks, and visiting them was fun. You get a set of hillbilly directions to get there, things like turn right at the sugar maple with some drip cans nailed to it. And those were these great adventures to me personally as an artist into the wilderness, because I'm an outsider and so is our hero, our folk singer. So he decides he's going to move out into the woods and then learn as much as he can from these old folk singers and from this guy Whirly Willard. And he does interview after interview with him until Whirly passes away. And then you won't hear it here, but the way that the scene ends is in a eulogy for Whirly.
In the tradition of those who collect folklore. And you said it's a chance for you also to be academic.
I think many people in Arkansas who love this sort of thing, they want to be your Vance Randolph, they want to be Mary Celestia Parlor, they want to be Donald Harrington, want to be collectors of these fascinating Ozark stories. And our character does too here. And it did give me a chance to take some of the academic folklore work I'd done and just literally plug it into a script.
In Whirly's house, we were investigating multiple and disparate historical moments in order to deeply consider past, present, and future in various figures, patterns, and flourishes that enacted the whole history of immigrant poverty and colonization in this region. A performance that momentarily clogged the machine of post-industrial capitalism. Everything in person. Everything by ear. Everything in a house that a man built himself. All right. Okay. That was a Whirly Willard playing Knock Around a Kitchen Till the Cook Comes Home, learned from his grandmammy, Myla Willard. It's January 2nd of 1996, and, well, we're about snowed in here on Jasper Mountain in this little lean-to that Whirly calls a house, so if you're hearing this, please put a carton of Parliaments, a case of beer, and two boxes of Fruit Loops at the bottom of the mountain, then go the heck away. Oh, that tune's crooked as a dog's hind leg and half as long, old boy. Nah, I don't want to play anything. Nah, I just want to listen to you. I just want to listen. Till I die.
Do you use a tape recorder in this section?
We do, yeah. So he interfaces with a tape recorder back and forth.
And then it takes on a darker and deeper meaning about this idea of capturing the human voice and the distancing yourself from the live and in-person playing of music and that separation between this is what we call the dark machine, taking over that and changing the folk tradition, changing how we interpret and deal with music.
This section asks the question, what does it mean to learn something? What does it mean to inherit something? But also, what does it mean to record something and to put it in an archive? What does that do to living traditions? There's this disturbing difference between the archive and the living repertoire. And that's kind of what the whole play is here's this living man who is a living repertoire of this culture who is about to die. And he's afraid of the archive. The archive is in a certain way like what kills you. And so while interfacing with this tape recorder, eventually it has to try to reckon with that sort of
thing. The archive is what kills you, but what keeps you alive? So tell us about the little section with the accordion.
So after he goes out to the wilderness, he's reminded of his own impending demise.
Folks, I hope I play the same song all throughout eternity. It's not a great song, and I didn't write it, but it's a song nonetheless. Legend tells that it began as a poem scribbled on the walls of a Kansas City jail cell by a man named One Finger Ellis. From there, it was passed on to the likes of Pete Seeger, Al Jolson, and Hobo Jack Turner. After that, it was passed on to Harry Mack McClintock, who passed it on to Utah Phillips, who passed it on to Mark Ross, who passed it on to Len Bolin, who passed it to me.
And what you're hearing at the end of this is he's found that acceptance. He's found his answer to how he can reconcile his own death. And it's a pitch for the angels.
It's almost like he's trying to bargain his way into heaven somehow. He's trying to say, my life isn't useless. I learned this song from this chain of honored ghosts that led to me learning it. And now, because I'm about to be a ghost myself, I give it to you as my last act in the world.
It's a song nobody owns, like a god dang national park, but one everybody wrote. Oh, why don't you work like other folks do? How can I hold a job when the sky is so blue? Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bums again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
And he suggests the present is a gift. I'm giving this gift to you.
At the end, the audience is invited to sing along, and so to be invited into this literal folk process as a way of ending the show.
Folks, I have a recurring dream that I'm standing at the gates of heaven and St. Peter turns to me and says, brother, did you sing in your last day? I'm just trying to make sure we have the right answer.
The present is where your memories come from and where your future is held. It's being present and prescient.
Oh, why don't you save all the money you earn? If I didn't need, I'd have money to burn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bums again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bums again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
As heady as this play might sound in terms of its academics or in terms of the rest of it, it really is just an old man experiencing all of these things over and over. And this is, I think, what makes our jumps into different time zones interesting, is because he's always there. It's always a place that he actually inhabits, and very rarely commentary on here's what I am, here's what I'm doing. While he's a pontificator, he doesn't do a whole lot of pontificating.
How have you found yourself out of the dilemma you've put yourself in, which is we're in the present, this is what matters, but at the same time we're chronicling that of the folk singer throughout history, and then imagining that it might be captured, like now, as an archival moment?
As an artist, by insisting that I have a working, evolving repertoire of music and that I never stop listening and trying to learn new things from people who know more than me.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thanks to Mr. Chris Hickey, who recorded the show. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to musician and writer Willie Carlisle and director and designer Joseph Fletcher, whose play answers the question affirmatively, yes, there is vitality in the music and culture of our grandparents. Praise be to the folk singer and for being the great cataloger and categorizer and herald of the woes of otherwise forgotten people. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Woody Guthrie. It's a folk singer's job to comfort disturbed people and to disturb comfortable people.